This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. Today, Neil Dahlstrom will join us, and we'll talk John Deere in just a moment. First off, Brad Rippey is a meteorologist with USDA.
We are slow on the corn emergence. 61% emerged by May 29th, five-year average 68%, and last year 79% on May 29th. Again, the big emergence delays, the far upper Midwest, led by North Dakota, just 7% of the corn emerged on May 29th. Five-year average is 42%, last year 60%.
Rippey looks at soybean emergence.
Soybean emergence, like corn, lagging the five-year average pace due to the late planting progress. 39% is the number for soybean emergence on May 29th, 4 points behind the five-year average of 43%. 20 percentage points behind last year's 59%.
This is the Agribusiness Report. I'm Tony St. James. We're joined today by Neil Dahlstrom. Neil is the manager of archives and history at John Deere and is also an author. And Neil, when I say author, we're going to focus on one of those books, but you've actually written quite a few books, haven't you?
Yeah, this is actually my third book, but it's my first in a while, so I'm really excited about this one.
Well, speaking of this book, it's called Tractor Wars, and the subtitle is John Deere, Henry Ford, International Harvester, and the Birth of Modern Agriculture. First off, let's talk about you and your journey to the position you're at now as far as being with John Deere. How did all that come about?
Yeah, it came about in a roundabout way. When I was a kid, I wanted to be Indiana Jones, and I liked digging into history, and that kind of developed into a love of archives, which I studied in school. And in 2001, I had a friend at John Deere who said, "Hey, they're hiring an archivist." And my response was, "John Deere has an archive." And so I applied for the job. And got the job, but really it was a homecoming for me. I grew up in the Quad Cities in East Moline, Illinois. John Deere's based in Moline. So for me, it was very much a homecoming. I've got family ties to John Deere, to Case IH, to Minneapolis Moline, to a lot of these farm brands that I actually talk about in the book.
Well, and that's a good place to just jump in here. The American Tractor Wars, is that a good place to start with the question of what were the American Tractor Wars?
Yeah, it is, and it's not a title I came up with. That actually comes from Cyrus McCormick III. Of course, International Harvester grew out of the McCormick Company, and in the 1930s, Cyrus McCormick, who went on to become a vice president at International Harvester, wrote this history of his family's business. And he was talking specifically, when he used the phrase tractor wars, to talk about a period in the early 1920s where there were price wars. Started by Henry Ford and his Fords and Tractor, he dropped the price to $395. And International Harvester quickly matched his price cuts. They were the number two. And then most of the 150-plus companies that were trying to build tractors at that time had to follow suit. So that's really where the phrase comes from. But the book overall starts earlier than that, kind of the story before, the story during, and then where it ended up in the late 1920s.
Maybe that's a good place to ask then. You know, we've grown up in a day and age where I don't think any of us here or who are listening remember a time before there was a tractor. But getting the tractor, I guess, two farmers, that was an interesting process. What actually led to that happening?
Yeah, it was really a new technology. So think about technology adoption with your early adopters, and kind of think of your bell curve of, okay, who follows suit. You've got a lot of early machines that didn't do what their makers said they did. So there's a lot of growing pains with that. You've got infrastructure issues to deal with. If you buy a new machine and it breaks down, who do you go to for repairs? You know, you have to have trained mechanics. And when every machine's different, when there's no standards in place, it's all confusing and complicated for consumers. So that's a big part of the story as well.
Now, the actual tractor you mentioned in there, and I guess we have as well, John Deere, you mentioned Henry Ford, International Harvester. What was some of the real story kind of behind that, and what will we find in the book that you have been able to excavate, if you will?
It's really an interesting story, and I took the approach of trying to get behind the scenes. Who was working together? Who was making decisions? For example, at John Deere, when William Butterworth became the company's third CEO in 1907, some of the credit agencies and bankers said, yeah, we don't think he's going to be very successful. He's not really cut out for this. International Harvester, a different story. Alexander Legg, who grew up on a farm and spent time as a cowboy, was a salesman, worked his way up through the company, and really just kind of accelerated the growth of the farm tractor and International Harvester as a company. But the book is very much centered around Henry Ford. He introduces his Model T in 1908 in October, and only a month later, he sends a short letter and a photo to the Farm Implement News, which was an ag publication, and said, this is an experimental tractor I'm working on. Well, the Model T was so successful, he stopped taking orders. He sells 11,000 in the next year, and people start to take notice, and they say, oh, maybe there's something to this tractor thing if Henry Ford's going to do it. Well, the other thing that happened is you're going to wait because you like your Model T, so I'm going to wait for a Ford tractor. So it kind of slowed things down. Then when he finally gets into production during World War I, he sends tractors over to Great Britain, about 6,000 of them. So it's really not until 1918 when he introduces the Ford in the United States that the industry as a whole really accelerates.
Yeah, and the market share, I guess, that Ford had, early on, why did they stop building the tractors?
It has a lot to do with the automobile industry. By the mid-1920s, Henry Ford has 75% market share for his Fords and tractor. He keeps telling everyone he's going to build a million a year. He barely gets over 100,000, which is still an incredibly significant amount. But what's happening by the mid-1920s is he's losing market share every year in the automobile business. Other manufacturers are passing him by. The Model T, which he says is a perfect automobile. It was perfect in 1915, but not so much in 1925 or 1926. His son Edsel finally convinces him to develop a new tractor or a new automobile, or at least approve it. The other side of that is Henry Ford lost $100 on every tractor he sold. So he was not in it for profit. He was in it because he thought it was important to the industry. Remember, he's a farm kid. He grew up on a farm outside of Michigan. He first saw a steam engine on wheels when he was 12, and his lifelong dream was to build tractors. And he often said he was trying to remove drudgery from the farm and hard labor from the farm. So it was very much a labor of love, but he had to sacrifice that in order to regain his automobile empire. And that happens when he drops out, at least domestically, in the late 1920s.
So I'm going to mention a couple of towns in Texas, and maybe you can help us understand how they factor into this. But let's say Mahia, Mercedes, why would those even be coming up in a conversation?
Yeah, they're really important because in particular, John Deere and International Harvester were testing some of their early machines down there. Deere was developing a what was called a motor cultivator, as was International Harvester, another company. It was meant to be kind of a bridge between a horse and a tractor. Some of them even had leather reins for steering instead of an actual steering wheel. They were trying to simulate what it was like to drive a horse. But both of those companies were doing a lot of their early experimental work Farmall or International Harvester with their Farmall tractor, John Deere with their all-wheel drive, later with their general purpose tractor in the 1920s. Another city that's really prominent was Dallas. And that's because in 1916, what I think is one of the seminal kind of years of the early tractor industry, is a lot of manufacturers got together and created what they called the National Tractor Demonstration. And what they did was they started in July of 1916. The event actually started in Dallas. So you have over 100 manufacturers of tractors shipping machines to Dallas and holding a 4 or 5 day event so customers can actually come and see these things in operation for the first time. This event ran through the entire summer, started in Dallas, ran through Kansas, Missouri, Fremont, Nebraska, and eventually wound down in Madison, Wisconsin in September. So there's a lot of history, especially in Texas, with this early tractor industry.
Well, Neil, we've been talking about a book which I believe was just released this week, Tractor Wars, the John Deere Henry Ford International Harvester and the Birth of Modern Agriculture. Tell us where we can, if we're interested in picking up a copy of this, how do we do that?
I always encourage people to go to their local bookstores. And then, of course, you can always go online to places like Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or Amazon to order as well.
Well, and again, the name of the book is Tractor Wars, John Deere, Henry Ford, International Harvester, and the Birth of Modern Agriculture. The author is Neil Dahlstrom. And Neil is also the Manager of Archives and History at John Deere. And this is the Agribusiness Report.
When Manitou set out to build the all-new MLT 737 telehandler, they built it with your needs in mind. Designed for ultimate efficiency with quick hydraulic movements, a wide range of attachments, and easier maintenance, you'll have time on your hands. And since productivity and comfort are closely linked, you won't find a better place than the cab of an MLT 737 telehandler to get the job done. Learn more at LivingstonMachinery.com and to find a location near you. Livingston Machinery, 24/7 service for your 24/7 operation.
The formula for success is a simple one. Put strong in, get strong out. That's why cotton growers looking to improve yield potential plant Delta Pine brand cotton, featuring 100 years of proven yield potential and exclusive genetics in every bag. Strong is a legacy all its own. Protect yours with strong cotton from Delta Pine. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
It's the Agribusiness Report.
Corn and soybean planting is beginning to catch up to the five-year average, but it's put emergence behind schedule and is cause for some worry later on.
That does put more of the crop into reproduction, into the potential heat of summer.
Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey says growers naturally would prefer to get crops through the more vulnerable reproductive stage before the worst of the summer heat develops.
So there is some risk this year. If we do get a hot stretch or a dry stretch a bit later into the midsummer, that could have more an effect than usual on corn and soybeans.
So as usual,
it really depends on the timing of weather extremes from this point forward,
which nobody can predict. So this season will be a watch and wait and hope growing season for corn and for soybeans as well. Gary Crawford, Washington.
It's the Agribusiness Report. The best thing you can put on your crop is your shadow. Your need to be in the field won't change, and the Cotton Research and Promotion Program was put into place to make sure you get the most from every minute you're out there. That's why the Cotton Board and Cotton Incorporated work alongside growers to spur innovation, fund research, and foster sustainability so generations of farming families can walk the same turn rows for years to come. Forever Cotton. Visit cottonboard.org/forevercotton.
Success is attained by those who approach problems with a plan and a purpose. As an advocate for High Plains cotton growers since 1956, Plains Cotton Growers has been tackling the tough issues facing cotton growers through beneficial legislative and regulatory changes. An important part of PCG's success is through close working relationships with congressional representatives and federal regulatory staff, allowing cotton growers more time to devote to farming operations. From the halls of Congress to the dusty turn roads of the High Plains, cotton producers depend on Plains Cotton Growers.
It's the Agribusiness Report. Find a copy of Tractor Wars on Neil's website, neildahlstrom.com.
The formula for success is a simple one. Put strong in, get strong out. That's why cotton growers looking to improve yield potential plant Delta Pine brand cotton, featuring 100 years of proven yield potential and exclusive genetics in every bag. Strong is a legacy all its own. Protect yours with strong cotton from Delta Pine. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Texas Corn Producers serves the state's corn farmers through both the Corn Board and the Association. The board is putting your checkoff dollars to work in research, promotion, and education to ensure producer profitability and market expansion. The member-supported association is the farmer's advocate in Austin and Washington, D.C. on issues from the Farm Bill, water and property rights, and more. Join the Texas Corn Producers Association today and get the latest news and information about Texas Corn Producers' efforts online at www.texascorn.org.
Welcome back. It's the Agribusiness Report. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
In addition to committing targeted resources through the National Conservation Resource Service to incentivize climate-smart agricultural practices and soil health initiatives, the USDA, with the help of farmers, ranchers, and growers, launched the Climate-Smart Agriculture and Forestry Commodity Partnership Initiative. This initiative is going to provide $1 billion to accelerate more rapid adoption of climate-smart agriculture and forestry practices, more tools to accurately measure and verify the climate benefits of reduced greenhouse gases and of increases in stored carbon of certain climate-smart practices, and more markets through which climate-smart commodities can be sold at a higher value benefiting producers. Now, the response to this initiative has been, I think, overwhelming, with over 450 applications totaling $18 billion in requests on proposed projects across all states and all commodity groups.